see ourselves, rightly so, as a great agricultural nation. And so it's really comforting when you read something that says, well, actually, some people in the rest of the world could learn from us. And that's what happened the other day when I was reading an article, Rethinking Agricultural Research and Innovation in West Africa. The article is by Ndidi Nwaneli, and it basically cites a couple of other countries that she thinks West Africa could look at. Joining me now from Nigeria is Ndidi Nwaneli. Ndidi Nwaneli, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you mentioned about a farmer who's, you know, growing maize and in Katsina, a northern part of Nigeria, and he wants rains. And if the rains are delayed, he's going to be in real trouble. He shares that experience with plenty of people in the region. But the underperformance in that area is not assisted by researchers in Nigeria. In other words, you're saying they're not listening to farmers like Adamu, the maize farmer in Katsina State.
Yes.
Well, who are they listening to?
Well, the sad reality is that many of these institutions are really divorced from what's going on in the market. They're listening to themselves and to government officials who are funding them. And their activities are really divorced from market forces. And so that's the sad reality, that very few of them actually have any links to the private sector or to the farmers themselves. And we have in Nigeria over 30 research institutions, and in West Africa, over 60 research institutions that are dedicated to agriculture.
But they're not doing the right job.
Well, the sad reality is that what they're generating, the research they're generating, is not filtering into the market, and it's not making the impact it should.
When you say it's not filtering through to the market, does that mean they are doing some research that could be valuable and they're just not communicating it? Or are they doing research that isn't suited to that market?
So there are two things. I think you've captured both. They are doing some interesting research, but it's not filtering to us. And the second is that some of the research they're doing is actually not the most important research for the current situation that most farmers face. What I saw in Australia was that there was a more direct link between what farmers needed and what the research institutions were doing. And there was a close incentive for the research institutions to want to do what the farmers or the processors need. So the whole concept of demand-driven research, where you actually find out on an annual basis what the problems the farmers are facing, how they can address it, I think that link is broken. So there's very little communication between the research institutions and the private sector, and there's also very limited feedback as to what the needs are and how those needs should be met.
And what caught my eye was a compliment to Australia, and that's just, you know, obvious. If you come from one country, you necessarily see a compliment and think, oh, well, you know, that's pretty good. But you particularly refer to the Australian Export Grains Innovation Centre as being a good idea, largely, I think, because it's funded by farmers who want to benefit from, you know, improvements through that research. And therefore, they're happy to pay a levy because there's some connection between them and the research.
Yes, I really enjoyed my visit to the Australian Export Grains Innovation Centre, and I was struck by two things. First, that they were very demand-driven. Because the farmers pay a levy at the point of export to the Grains Council, and that's how it's funded, the Grains Council is very interested in making sure that they feed back information to the farmers as to what exporters need, what international customers need. So is it how smooth the needle is? How does that feed into what type of wheat varieties the farmer should be growing? So that direct communication and that link is really important. And it also incentivizes both the farmers to change behavior and the export council to get the right information and feed it back. So that loop is very important. And making sure that that loop is current, it's relevant, and it's timely. That communication mechanism is really critical, and I was very impressed to see how that works in Australia. And that was a great example for us in West Africa.
Mm. And just to share a bit of the love around, there's a similar example in Brazil.
Yes. So Embrapa is also a very dynamic organization in Brazil. It was established in 1973, and it's really evolved to be probably one of the leading research institutions in the world. And they have worked in a range of sectors, pork, chicken, grains, essentially saying we're going to work with our farmers, we're going to develop research that's relevant, and we're going to ensure that we can not only improve the productivity of the farmers, but also ensure that they're linked to technology and they're dynamic and relevant. And so Brazil is one of the largest exporters of animal protein globally, but also we have so much to learn from what they're doing around feed systems and soil health to improve the productivity of farmers in that region.
Mm. Well, quadrupling the beef and pork supply is an achievement, and a 22-fold increase in chicken. I mean, that's a real assistance to farmers. At the farm gate, that means more money in your pocket, doesn't it?
Exactly, exactly. And what has evolved from a government entity is now recognized as one of the most dynamic organizations. And so that gives me a lot of hope that our research institutions in West Africa can be transformed in my lifetime from being very bureaucratic and focused on their own research to be market-driven.
Yeah. And you mentioned another Australian example, AgriBio, a partnership between the government and La Trobe University. You think that's a good example as well, where governments work with universities?
Yes, I do. I do. I mean, what struck me about the AgriBio example was that it took them 25 years to evolve, basically almost consolidating a lot of the disparate institutions and research efforts into one hub. And today, I mean, they devote 70% of their activities in addressing the challenges posed by the private sector. And then obviously another 30% focused on regional priorities. It's always good for research institutions to also be devoting time to, you know, forward-thinking issues, futuristic issues, but they still have to be relevant today. And when I visited that institution, I said, okay, it took them 25 years, so there's hope. I shouldn't give up just yet. It wasn't easy, but they did it. And they're still work in progress, obviously. But what it proves to me that it's possible is to see all the large private companies partnering with them and funding the activities. And the role of academic institutions is critical because you have all these brilliant PhD students who can be working on relevant research for the sector.
Mm, indeed. Well, you've seen some hope, haven't you, in West Africa, in Côte d'Ivoire?
Yes. So in Côte d'Ivoire, there is quite a good example. There's an organization called Centre National de Recherche Agronomique de Côte d'Ivoire, which is basically funded by private providers and producers. The main export product in Côte d'Ivoire is cocoa, and 70% of the subscription fees raised by the producers are basically used to fund this research institution. And it's proved to be a sustainable approach, and the cocoa farmers are benefiting from the great research that this institution does. So there's hope, and we're seeing it in our own backyard. What we need to do is scale it beyond Côte d'Ivoire to other West African countries, including Nigeria.
Mm. Are there any other examples other than Côte d'Ivoire?
Well, in South Africa, you see a lot of this happening as well. And the good news is that even the Nigerian government is looking at a policy where we can generate some percentage of export revenues and devote them to local research. And that current policy is pending in the National Assembly. So we're starting to see some hope even in our own backyard. And clearly, by sharing the best practices from other countries, you see some light bulbs going off. People say, okay, it's been done before, it can be done again. There are also a few examples in Tanzania similar to what we've seen in Côte d'Ivoire. But in West Africa, we don't have enough examples, and that's why I'm encouraged to push out these best practices and hope that they change mindsets.
Well, changing mindsets is not easy. It takes time. But as you say, with the example in Brazil and in Australia, these things can be done. If it's starting in Africa, in West Africa at least, that's an example that neighbouring countries will be pushed by their farmers, no doubt, to take note from and to follow. So that's all a good thing. I have to say, Ndidi Nwele, thank you very much for joining us. Thanks for the compliments to Australia, and give my best to your High Commissioner, or our High Commissioner.
I will do so. Thanks so much. Have a wonderful day.